Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin. And on the show, we are not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's show, we're going to discuss these things. And wait a minute. We got a malfunction at the junction. Special announcement from the good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe. Folks, after hours and hours of secret negotiations, top secret negotiations, we have talked to John McAdam. He said no. We talked to John Hitchcock. He said no. We talked to Dave Flaherty, for God's sakes, and he said no. But finally, we went with the lowest amount we could possibly pay somebody, and we're pleased to announce that as of this show, Barry Rose is our permanent co-host. Hello, Barry.
You know, you're so full of it, too. Let's be honest. I'm actually paying you to do this. And you know that, and I know that, and Flaherty knows that as well.
I can't believe Dave Flaherty didn't take my offer.
Dave, well, you know what? If you had paid him in liquor, did I just say that? Yeah, if you had paid him in liquor, he might be doing it. But, you know, I am so pumped up today for today's show. I'm sitting on my couch. I've got my trusty dog, Ozzy, by my side, my super big gulp, and I'm just so excited about our guest today.
Well, today, folks, we are going to do a deep dive. We are going to break kayfabe on Japanese wrestling, and I'd like to introduce Barry's friend and mine, Eric Chulminski. Eric, say hello.
Hello, everyone. Barry, my long-lost friend. How are you?
And I'm great, man. How are you?
Go ahead, Jeff.
I've read your name for years. Nice to finally talk to you.
Absolutely. The reason we have Eric on the show today, folks, we're going to do, as I said at the opening, a deep dive on Japanese wrestling. And it's funny, I've talked to Eric a few times on the phone, and, you know, lo and behold, here I've worked in the court system for 32 years. And Eric, why don't you tell the good folks what you do up there in Philadelphia?
I am a court officer at criminal court in Philadelphia.
So basically, he has the same job I do. What are the chances of that happening? And two guys that work in court and also both are into Japanese wrestling. Go figure. And also into Tom Petty, which, by the way, we are going to be discussing towards the end of our program today. We're each going to offer you our top five Tom Petty songs. As you know, recently we lost Tom Petty. Tom was such a key figure in my life as far as my love for music, one of my favorite artists of all time. We're going to talk a little Tom Petty towards the end of the broadcast. But before we do that, we're going to talk about Japan. Before we get into that, Eric has a Facebook page. Eric, why don't you tell the good folks about where they can find you on Facebook and talk a little Japanese wrestling?
Yeah, so I run the Classic Japanese Pro Wrestling Facebook group. Right now, it's a secret group, so you cannot find it through the search. You would need an existing member like Barry to add you.
So you got to be a decent person. You're not going to just take anybody in your group. Is that true?
No. Yeah. So now, you know, you would get a lot of the spam if you had it open, and it just becomes very problematic.
You don't want somebody like Brian Last coming on there, because that guy, he just starts, you know, all kind of trouble on a message board. So we'll keep him off. But if you're lucky enough to get an invite, maybe you can go on there. I also know you're doing a special fundraiser. Why don't you tell the folks about that real quick?
Yeah. So recently, Yoshihiro Takayama was seriously injured in a match, doing the most basic of moves, a sunset flip, and now he's just paralyzed, and it's just an awful situation for him and his family. So a lot of the shows over there are running this donation drive at the shows where people are just dropping yen in a box. So we started running a drive for Takayama where people can pay through PayPal to PayPal ID is beerman37@aol.com. And we've so far amassed $3,200 to
get. Wow, that's pretty impressive. Takayama.
Yeah, we're, you know, I just saw a Twitter post where someone posted that the DDT promotion so far has amassed 720,000 yen for Takayama at their shows. And what we've got so far is about 365,000 yen just from our Facebook group and Twitter. So we've done half of what the DDT promotion has done. So it's really, really been nice. You know, wrestling fans get a lot of gruff from people, you know, like we're Neanderthals to some people. And, you know, it's a nice thing to do to somebody who's given a lot of entertainment to people over the years. And like I said, it's beerman37 at AOL.com. If you want to donate, every dollar helps. I'm heading over there on December the 29th. And we've been able to secure a meeting with Minoru Suzuki to deliver the money to him directly.
Wow, that's awesome. So I would certainly encourage any listeners who would like to make a contribution to reach out to Eric. Again, Eric, the address that they could reach you at?
It's beerman37 at AOL.com. And come on, everybody. That Don Fry fight's got to be worth at least $5. I mean, come on.
It's super commendable, too. You know, when you read all these different things, there was a guy last week that wanted to market his potato salad and started to GoFundMe for that. And then there was actually a wrestling guy, too, a wrestler who had his boots stolen and was doing a GoFundMe to buy him a new pair of boots. But something like this, I'm going to go and contribute. Just hearing about this today. It's incredible, Eric.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good stuff.
Did one of these last year. Another wrestler, Joe Doring in All Japan, had a bout with brain cancer, and we were able to get him $2,000 last year. So this is the second one that we've actually done. So it's pretty nice. These guys give a lot to us, so it's nice to give back sometimes.
Absolutely. That's very good stuff. So, all right, guys, you ready to do a deep dive into some Japanese wrestling here?
Let's do it.
Okay. The first match we're going to talk about is Akira Maeda and Nobuhiko Takada versus Yoshiaki Fujiwara and Kazu Yamazaki. We're talking September 1st, 1987. And this was one of my top 100 matches. And I've recently had a chance to go back and see this. And Eric, I know you, being a big fan of Japanese wrestling and Japanese wrestling history, also, you texted me, I believe, last night telling me you had just seen it. And why don't you tell me first what you thought of this match and whether or not you think it deserves to be one of the top 100 of the decade?
Well, you actually faked me out because I thought the one that we were going to talk about was the March 20th match. I mean,
well, we're supposed to roll with the punches here, Eric. Go ahead.
We're highbrow,
by the way.
Yeah. The March 20th match is actually a much better match, I think. But the match you're talking about with Yamazaki and Fujiwara, that's just four complete badasses in there. And Maeda and Takada is such a great old team. You know, they're largely forgotten. It's 30 years ago. They weren't around that much together. And it's they're just kicking the hell out of these guys. And Yamazaki gets the pin out of nowhere, which is this great upset finish. But, you know, like I said, I like the other match more.
I had both matches on the top 100. And Barry, did you get a chance to see this?
Yeah, I did. And I love this match too, and it's I have a great story to tell about Fujiwara. So there was Jeff. I don't think you were there. This was 1991 or 92, and there was an MMA show in Miami Beach. I forget exactly where it was, and Jimmy Berkeley came down. Jimmy Jett, WCW referee, came down from Orlando. We actually went to the show together. And Ken Shamrock was there. Fujiwara was there. And everybody's favorite, Lana, was there. So we got to go backstage. And I forget what the connection was that we got to go backstage. But to me, it was kind of cool because I had been watching the UWFI stuff. And I saw Fujiwara. And this is prior to his match. So I walk up to him, and I extend my hand, and he just stares me in the face, and he doesn't say a word to me. So I'm a goofball. I start to smile at him. It's an honor to meet you, sir. And he just stares me down. I literally could feel the dagger. So I walk away, and somebody comes up to me, and I forget exactly who it was, and they say, you know, he doesn't like to talk to anybody prior to his matches. And I was like, oh, all right. So, you know, I didn't think much about it. The card ended. We go back in the locker room area afterwards, and he sees me, and he comes over, and he extends his hand, and he shakes my hand. Didn't explain anything. We actually took a photo together. But the one thing, this match I thought was fantastic. And Yamazaki, I guess I wasn't as familiar with Yamazaki as I was the other three competitors. But there's a sequence in there, kind of towards the first couple of minutes between Fujiwara and Takada, where they're doing the slaps and the chops. And these aren't the Ric Flair chops or, you know, even a Wahoo chop. They're full out slapping each other in the face. and just super intense. And Maeda does, that's one thing too, every time I watch a match, he does a new version of a suplex that I've never seen before. And he's doing it, he did this really unique suplex, a side suplex, that I had never seen. I thought it was super cool. But as Eric just mentioned, too, to me, the ending was a huge surprise. I didn't see Yamazaki going over, and he does, and it kind of comes out of nowhere. I thought the finish was great. I thought the entire match was great.
Well, here's a couple things that I'll point out after I watch the match. First of all, when the guys are in the ring, the respect that each of them have for one another is pretty obvious. These are four guys that had been through the original UWF, had come back to New Japan, and the crowd totally believes in this. The suspension of disbelief is totally present, because even though it's a New Japan match, when these guys get in the ring with one another, the crowd totally believes what's going on. Maeda is almost comes across as like this big brother to Takada and to Yamazaki. Fujiwara, you talked about him, and Eric had mentioned Minoru Suzuki earlier. Boy, you watch Minoru Suzuki today in New Japan, he reminds me so much of Fujiwara in the mid to late 80s. He's like the same guy, this guy that sort of is very nondescript looking, but you just know is this huge badass that could pretty much take anybody in the industry out. He's not someone to be trifled with. As you mentioned, Barry, the suplexes in this match are just off the charts. I mean, they're hitting stuff, hitting each other with stuff, you know, moves where you're like going, where in the hell did that come from? Oh, my God. Yamazaki, I think, probably has the quickest kicks I'd seen in the pro wrestling business since when Sayama first exploded on the mainstream. He's so fast with his kicks in the corner. The kicks that he puts on Takata are just amazing. The transitions these guys do on the holds are so quick. It's just absolutely amazing. And I also noted, as Barry said, the slaps these guys are laying on one another across the face. I mean, they're not pulling anything. They're flat out laying them into one another. And the kicks are pretty brutal, too. And they're giving each other headshots, for God's sakes.
Yeah. Those are some hateful slaps.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I mean, it's amazing, because you would think that guys that have this much respect for one another, you know, to just lay them in like that, it's just really amazing. As someone said, I believe it was Eric, Yamazaki hits the back suplex on Takata. Huge upset. And the crowd just absolutely explodes. And then after, what I really thought was cool was after the finish, when Fujiwara and Yamazaki had gone over, the fact that Maeda and Takada don't bail. They stay in the ring. They go over and they shake each guy's hand. They congratulate him. I thought that was a really cool sign of respect that, you know, they obviously had for their opponents. And, this is about as good and stiff a tag team match as you could ever want. I don't know that it's out there on YouTube. If it's not, you can certainly find it on New Japan World, and it's worth seeking out because this is really good stuff.
It is on YouTube. That's where
that's great.
Located it. Yes,
I'll post a link to it because it's definitely worth seeking out.
Yeah, like what you guys mentioned, one of the things that I like about those four back in that era, you know, it's like that crowd sits there doing. I mean, Japan wrestling is more realistic anyway, but. You know, they're sitting there through these undercard matches, and then these guys come out, and you can just feel like a different vibe in that audience that they believe that these four guys are really cracking each other around. You know, so it's just such a great atmosphere with those old Maeda and Takada matches where the crowd sees them as legitimate badasses that you don't want to mess around with. You know, and it's just always such a great atmosphere at those matches that they had.
So, Eric, what was the other match that you were talking about? You had mentioned that besides this one, they had met a second time and you felt that match was actually better?
No. So, Jeff gave me an original list of matches, and the match that I thought he was going to talk about today is Maeda and Takada against Keiji Muto and Shiro Koshinaka back in March. And that is just tremendous. I like that match better than this one. That's for it's a tournament final for the tag team titles. And it's another huge upset because Koshinaka gets the pin and the crowd just goes bananas when he gets the pin. Ah, such a great match. I like that one actually even better.
Well, I tell you what, Eric, as long as you brought it up, let's talk about that. That match took place on March 20th of 1987. And let me just tell you people something. If you have New Japan World if you want to go back to watch some great, unbelievable wrestling, I think 1987 New Japan is probably about as exciting a promotion as you could watch in a 1 year period. Let's take a look and discuss what happened during that period. In March, you had the famous match with Saito and Inoki, where Riki Choshu has left All Japan. He's returned to New Japan. He's sitting in the audience with the rest of his guys who have made their return to New Japan, but aren't officially members of the crew yet. Choshu begins verbally getting into it with Inoki in the ring. Fujinami comes out, who, of course, is Choshu's most famous rival at that point. Choshu is getting into it with Inoki. Fujinami attempts to step between them, and Choshu reaches out from in the audience, slaps Fujinami across the face. The crowd just starts going bananas because they know the feud is being reunited. So you've got the guys with Riki Choshu's group. You've got Inoki's group. Now you still have the UWF guys there in their group. There is so much talent in this promotion during that particular year. And on March 20th of that year, you had the tournament finals with Takada and Maeda against Shiro Koshinaka and Kijimuto. And one of the things that was great about this match was, much like in an even bigger degree, the belief that Koshinaka and Muto could beat the Takada Maeda team was, you know, there was just no belief whatsoever that these guys were ever going to beat the UWF guys. And when they did it, it was such a huge upset. And again, the crisp suplexes that Maeda is throwing in this match is unbelievable. And you really get a feel that the Koshinaka and Muto team are like athletes, whereas the UWF guys are legitimate wrestlers. And here again, we've got a guy that does a suplex into a spike pile driver. The moves that they're doing is just incredible. There's a spinning back kick that I think Takada does that nails Koshinaka right in the chin. And the crowd just slowly, slowly builds. And by the time the ending comes, they just explode. It's just an incredible way of building up the match to this explosive finish. Eric, tell us more about that.
So, first off, that ring announcer, I cannot believe no one uses this guy nowadays. That New Japan ring announcer is just the greatest. I mean,
that was the guy that Dave Meltzer referred to as rock star, because that's what he looked like.
He is just incredible. I mean, you get pumped up just from those ring announcements that he does. He is just really great. I just cannot believe he's not used nowadays. But yeah, like we said, that's a tournament final. Fujinami and Kengo Kimura were the champions, and I don't remember exactly what happened, but they had split up. I don't know if they had a falling out in a match, or if, you know, Fujinami just said, "Yeah, I just don't feel like doing this with you anymore." You know, I don't really remember exactly what the split was.
Now that I think about it, I think at the very beginning, like in January, Kengo Kimura and Fujinami had split their tag team that had been together for almost 5 years, and there was actually one card in Tokyo that was a one match card where it was just Fujinami versus Kimura. And I remember one of the things specifically about it was that they did it in a ring with no ropes. So like they made it a real, like played it off like it was a legit shoot, and they sold the building out. So literally for one match. So that program was a very short program, but it was very intense and very believable. So they
vacate the titles, and this is the finals, and the audience is kind of split if you're watching the match. I mean, they absolutely love the UWF. Gosh, this match, Maeda and Takada just kicked the bejesus out of these two poor souls. It's almost like you feel sorry for them after a while. It's like, my God, you know, there's a spinning back kick, like you said, with Takada hitting Koshinaka. It looks like right in the mouth. Even when you just rewind it and slow-mo it, it's just like, my goodness, how hard he's kicking these two. And Muda's very, very athletic at this time. He does a moonsault where he's like changing positions in midair in this match. It's like such a great atmosphere at Cork and Hall. They're so loud. And I always wondered stuff. You know, you always hear this stuff. Oh, you know, we go to Japan and the crowd's very quiet and shy and reserved, and I don't know, man. I watch these old matches and I'm like, what building are these people in? You know, like these crowds are going crazy during these matches. You know,
well,
like,
you know, and famously, the UWF guys were much more over in Tokyo and in the big cities than they were in the smaller towns, because the UWF Maniacs, as they called them, were the extremely rabid, devout guys that they wanted to see the UWF style. They were huge fans of the UWF that existed in 84 and I think into 85. So, yeah, but this was an incredible match. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I like this one a little better than that Yamazaki tag. So, but both of them deservedly so in the top 100. Two great, great matches. So,
okay, the next match we're going to talk about Tiger Mask. That's Tiger Mask 2, which is, of course, Misawa versus Pirata Morgan from Mexico. I am looking at December 8th, 1984. I recall that Dave Meltzer was in Japan at the time, saw this match, and famously posted in The Observer that this match was the quickest-paced match he'd ever seen in his life up to that point. Now, I got to tell you, as I see this match, I'm going to offer my own opinion in a second. Eric, Barry, what do you think about this match?
So I was surprised when you put this on your list, because when I rewatched it, it's just like this little 7-minute match, and it's a nice little match and all, and it's a little bizarre, you know, in hindsight, watching, you know, Misawa do stuff like this, you know, flipping around all over the place with a Halloween costume on, basically. And, but it's, you know, there's 1,000 matches better than this that you could name in 5 or 10 seconds. Doesn't really hold up compared to the stuff that you see nowadays. It's only 7 minutes long. It's just like a basic, the crowd is popping for a kick out for like a basic suplex, which is kind of weird, you know, compared to nowadays. But yeah, I don't know. You know, it's okay, this match, but you know, I didn't think it was anything special watching it 34 years later, you know, 30
okay,
years
Barry,
later.
Barry, what'd you think?
So I like the match, and I understand what Eric is saying as well. It's, you know, I remember seeing this match maybe within a year of it taking place and just being completely blown away because we weren't used to this kind of style. In hindsight, it's a great match. Pirata Morgan, I was such a fan, of his work with MS1 in Mexico, and just watching him, and the match kind of starts off, and it's kind of a wrestling match for maybe the first 2 minutes, and then it quickly turns into a lucha match. The crowd response too, which, you know, Eric just touched on too. So there's a series of flips from Tiger Mask 2, and the crowd is just going, oh, and you can really feel them and you can hear this. I was such a big fan of Morgan too, and, you know, such a unique character. And this was when he was really probably at his best. He would gain a lot of weight. Have you seen him recently, Eric or Jeff?
No.
Have you guys seen him in the last few years?
No, I have
He's
not.
Completely changed. And obviously, I want to say he's 55, 56 years old at this point, but he's got tattoos over his face, all over his body, but he's got face tattoos. So he's really, you know, he's changed his look tremendously. And, you know, I think Morgan really tries to keep up, but this is really the Tiger Mask show. If anything, this was really an opportunity for Misawa to shine, and he really does shine here.
Well, I tell you, I think that I have to agree with Eric. I don't really think this match holds up. I think he made a pretty valid point that while it's a good match, there's nothing wrong with the match, but it's the kind of match that, there are probably 50 to 100 matches that are better than this match. So I don't think this really belonged in hindsight on the top 100 match. I thought exactly the exact opposite of what you said, Barry. I thought this was really Misawa working Pirata Morgan's match, because I thought this almost came off like a match that could have been held in Mexico City. It seemed like, as far as the in-ring stuff, not the reaction of the crowd. I thought it came off almost like a lucha match, which seemed very strange. Go ahead. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, no, and I said that. I actually said it starts off as a wrestling match the first 2 minutes and then quickly evolves into a lucha match. What I said was, maybe I didn't explain it carefully, was that I don't think that Morgan did anything that's going to stand out at the end of this match. And when this match is over, all I'm going to remember are the spots that Misawa is doing.
Yeah. Now, that being said, the crowd is completely, as Eric referred to it, they're completely into this match, and they're popping huge for the slightest move, you know, that happens. So obviously, even at this point, Misawa was super over with the All Japan crowd. Tiger Mask ends up getting the suplex for the win. Again, this is not something I'm poo-pooing and saying this is a bad match. This is not, I would say this is not on the top 100. I would not say this is on the Don Nakai and Nielsen Akira Maeda level of just like completely not belonging, but it came off more as a good to very good match that didn't belong in the pantheon of great matches of the decade. So that's my thoughts on that.
There was a neat little spot in there, though, that I hadn't seen before, hadn't seen in a while, where Tiger Mask is going to do a back body drop, but it looks like Parada Morgan is trying to do like a high knee or something like that.
Yeah.
And he sort of backdrops him off his knee, which was kind of neat to see. You know, it was a neat little move. It wasn't your basic back body drop. He sort of, instead of back body dropping him off like his upper chest, he just sort of flung him up in the air from his knee, which was kind of neat. You know, that was a neat little spot, I thought.
So next we're going to talk, we're going to go into my top 20. And the match that I had at number 9 took place in Osaka on June 12th, 1987. Tatsumi Fujinami versus Akira Maeda. I know you both have recently watched this match. Let's start off with Barry. Barry, tell me what you thought of this match.
So, wow. When you watch this match, to me, it's as close to maybe as a shoot. And I know it's not. But at the same time, when I'm watching this match, I was kind of blown away with it. And Maeda he's such a polarizing figure, you know, between a lot of the stuff that he did in New Japan. I know that, you know, it was right around 86 when he came back to Japan, and then he had that infamous match with Andre the Giant, where Andre allegedly was, you know, a drunk and I guess in no condition to compete, and Maeda got pissed off and didn't want to lose to him because he was a WWF star. And then, you know, at the same time, he has this match against Fujinami, and there's a spot in this match where he kicks Fujinami in the head, and it's hard way, and Fujinami goes down, and he's gushing blood. And I have to feel that it wasn't intentional. The kick was intentional, but I don't think the injury was really meant to happen. And then, obviously, the triad with this would have been Maeda, you know, basically with the shoot kick to Riki Choshu's face. So when I watched this match, you know, I was such a huge fan of Fujinami, too. I felt he was kind of an underrated wrestler, and especially in hindsight. You know, he wasn't as flashy as some of the other guys, and maybe not as big or as strong as some of the other guys. But at the same time, he did so much that was right in my eyes. And in watching this match, you know, he held his own with Maeda. But as I said previously, this is Maeda's show. This is just where he can show what a badass he was. He comes off like a badass. If there's one thing that I guess I don't like about this match, and I don't want to spoil too much of it, I kind of hated the ending, but I'm guessing they had to do this ending based off of the injury to Fujinami's head. Eric, would that be correct?
I don't know. Like,
I can answer the question. The match was supposed to be a 30-minute draw, and they had to, after the injury that Fujinami essentially got a concussion from what happened was Maeda had Fujinami in the corner. He went in for the flying reverse leg kick, I guess, that he's done. He does like this rolling leg kick during a transition, but in this time he went to do the rolling leg kick into the corner. The heel of his boot catches Fujinami, I think, right above the eyebrow, and it was just like his head just exploded. And exploded. In doing so, yeah. And the blood is everywhere. They kind of immediately go to a go home. The towel is brought in, and they wrap Fujinami's head in a towel, and it's pretty soaked pretty quick. You know, they had to do that, you know, for a lot of political reasons to give the audience a finish. The crowd is going insane during this match. And I'll add more to that. Eric, your thoughts on the match?
As far as the finish, though, for a finish that's basically based on what you're saying is done on the fly, it's really good, because I just watched this about an hour before we went on the air, and the finish is, you know, Fujinami's just bleeding buckets all over this ring, and Maeda run, it's like a bounce off the ropes or something, and he goes into a spinning back kick, and Fujinami moves out of the way. And it looks like what they're trying to go for is Fujinami has just collapsed from blood loss, but by Maeda missing that spin kick, he lands on the mat head first and immediately grabs his head as if he just knocked himself senseless. And that's the double count out. And I was like, ah, oh, what a good little finish, you know, because he does a great little sell job by immediately grabbing his head, which I never really noticed before. When I watch this, you know, you're so focused on the blood all over the damn place. You know, I never really looked at, Maeda, you know, he just hit his head. That's why it's the double count out, because there's really, you know, he's on the offensive most of the time here. And it's like, he missed the kick and, you know, that knocked him, you know, that caused the count out, you know, who cares, you know. But when you watch it, you know, he sort of is trying to tell the story that he hit his head on that mat based on missing the spin kick. I mean, that's what I got out of it.
Yeah, and it was a really excellent job of both guys coming up with a finish on the fly.
Yeah, really good improvise.
And what happens is during the match, Maeda is just laying the kicks into Fujinami to the point where, you know, Barry said this almost came off like it was a work shoot. Fujinami, during this period, it was such a great, great wrestler. I believe in the following year, in 88, he was voted the Observer's Wrestler of the Year. Before he started having back problems, he sells during this match as Maeda keeps laying the kicks in. He sells almost like, I've used this expression before, but this is really what it was like. He was like a wounded animal in there.
So I took some notes, you know, as I was, you know, watching the match, and there's parts, I mean, Maeda is kicking him to death in the corner. And I'm just, did you ever watch something and, you know, it's so great, and you're just like laughing? Like, do you ever know, you know, why do you do that stuff? You know?
Yeah.
Like, you go to a show and the match is so great and you're just laughing because it's so great. You know, I did that with Okada and Omega at the Tokyo Dome this year. You know, we were just laughing because it was just so great.
Yeah.
And he is just kicking poor Fujinami to death. And yeah. Fujinami has this look on his face every time he falls on the ground, like, there's got to be something better in life than this. you know what I mean? It's like, what am I doing?
The notes that I made on the match is that it almost came off like a heavyweight title fight in boxing, because it was so physically grueling to watch what Fujinami is going through. And it really came off, you know, as I mentioned earlier, almost like a work shoot. Then the crowd treated it like that. This wasn't like a spot fest, you know, with some independent tag team match where they're, you know, flying all over the place. This was two guys beating the living, well, I should say one guy beating the living hell out of another guy.
Right.
And the other guy
right.
Just hanging on.
There's a spot in the beginning, you know, right in the beginning of the match, you know, they're doing the feeling out spots, and there's a lot of legwork from Maeda. And then they're doing that spot where it looks like the test of strength spot, where they've got their fingers interlocked, and then Maeda just jumps up and drop kicks Fujinami in the face out of nowhere. And Fujinami jumps up with this look on his face like, you mother effer. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I'm sitting here trying to have a good wrestling match with you and you kick me. And so he rears back and slaps him like, you know, almost like, don't you do that again. I was just like, oh, this is so, there is great respect in this match between these two, but there's a lot of hate. And, oh, Maeda just puts a beating on Fujinami. There's also a great spot at the end, because it's like that little stuff that you can't plan. Fujinami pile drives Maeda. It's like a desperation pile driver. And they're both sweating bullets, and Maeda slides right off Fujinami's chest. So, like, he gets pile driven and lands, like, on Fujinami's chest and just slides off from the sweat. And the people in the crowd are, like, standing, pumping their fists in the air, like, trying to will Fujinami to win this match. I mean, they are totally on Fujinami's side. I almost like they feel sorry for the guy because he's just getting beat so bad.
Well, and that was, match. You know, Maeda was playing the UWF tough guy and was doing such a good job of, he wasn't an out-and-out heel, but he was like a bully. And the crowd, you know, even though Maeda had his fans, the crowd just starts willing the poor, helpless Fujinami, trying to will him back. And it was really such great psychology in this match. And I got to tell you something. This match was in my top 10. It was number 9, as I said earlier. And this match, I think, absolutely, definitely still belongs in the top 10 matches of the decade. Barry, what do you think?
Before Barry says, I think this won the 1986 match of the year over there for the Tokyo Press.
You're 100% correct, because I looked that up prior to it. Again, it's a great match, and it's, I think one of the takeaways I have is there is a tremendous amount of respect between the two, and apparently Maeda, who did not respect a ton of people, he kind of respected Fujinami above everybody else. But he still, that doesn't stop him from literally kicking the crap out of him during the match.
I respect you, Booker, man.
Right, exactly. I'm going to beat your ass.
Exactly. Right. There is something, though. I don't know if anybody ever picked it. You know, in the very beginning of the match, this was driving me crazy watching this. So, did you ever watch a baseball game or, watch a sporting event? And the hard camera, and there's always that geek in the crowd on the cell phone waving at the camera. Doesn't that drive you crazy? People doing that, right? So this building has the giant screen, and in the beginning, every time that hard camera is focused on the crowd, all those people are looking at the screen and they're waving, And all I can think of is, oh, you geeks. You know what I mean? Like, watch the match in the ring. They're waving at themselves on this screen. And it was just driving me banana. Thankfully, the match gets so great that they stop it. But in the beginning, I was just like, oh, my God. You got this dream, fight. And they're waving at themselves on the screen. Even the reserve Japanese people are doing that silly stuff that you always see, like baseball games.
Yeah, nowadays they'd be holding up a Bully Club sign.
Yeah.
Eric, you said something a couple of minutes ago, too, and it jogged a memory. So you mentioned something about when you watch a match and you're seeing something that you think is so incredible that you start to laugh. And you and I saw a match in Philadelphia 3 or 4 years ago, and I don't know, I'm sure you're going to remember it. It was AJ Styles and the Young Bucks. And it was against Cedric Alexander, and I forget who else was in the match, but do you remember we looked at each other and go, holy shit, what are we seeing here? This is absolutely insane. And we were both laughing because it was so nuts.
Yeah, they were diving all over the place, and they were brawling out of the ring. And Jeff, I'm not sure if you know this, but we always go, me, Barry, and Barry's son, Zach, always go to the shows together here in Philadelphia. And there was so much going on here. At one point, I just looked over at Zach, and we just started laughing. We were just, no one said anything. We were just laughing at how insane that this match was.
Do you happen to remember who the other guy was?
I'm trying to remember. Was it Mike Bennett?
No, I don't think so. I want to say it was, who it was? It was Cedric Alexander, ACH, and Caprice Coleman.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, that was such a great match. That was like at a Ring of Honor TV taping or something.
Yeah, it was the main event. It was the last match after what was like 40 hours of TV tapings. That's what it seems like. It goes on forever.
Oh,
but the match just blew us away. And Eric and I are sitting there, and it's literally, we've probably been there for 4 or 5 hours, and they put on this match, and we're just looking at each other going, this is one of the, at least in my opinion, that was one of the best matches live I had seen in the last 2 decades.
Wow.
Yeah, that was great. So, on that same stretch, if you don't mind, I was in the audience in Japan in 2015 for Goshi Ozaki finally won the Triple Crown from Joe Doering. And I had the same reaction at the crowd during that match, where the guy sitting next to me didn't speak a word of English, like literally nothing. And these two are just having this all-time great match. And Shiozaki was one of those guys that always would, come close but never win the big one. And there was a couple close two counts where I looked next to me, and all of a sudden I was like, where did that guy go? And he had crumpled himself like on the floor. Like, he was so distraught that he thought that Doering was going to win this match that he had slid out of the chair, and he was like in a fetal position on the floor. And I'm, I'm picking this guy up, and I'm like, two, I'm going two. And he's like, oh, good, good, good. you know, but it's such a great match when you can get that reaction from a crowd, which is what's missing in a lot of these promotions nowadays, that the audience suspension of disbelief and just getting into a really great match isn't there anymore.
Sure.
Yeah,
so absolutely. Listen, let me just, while we're talking about this, I have to mention a book that I recently read that I want to recommend. It's a book that's been mentioned as the book of the week on the 605 podcast. That is a book called Lion's Pride. It's by Chris Charlton. It's a book about the history of New Japan wrestling from 72, I want to say up to 2000, maybe 16, but just all sort of historical background, historical context. It really introduces you to some of the players as in the game, as the promotion was going through the years. That book is available at tinyurl.com/lionspride amazon. That is a book that you should definitely seek out if you're interested in learning more about the history of New Japan Wrestling. Now, what I'm going to do on my my Facebook page, which, by the way, is Facebook.com Breaking Kayfabe. What I did was I posted something where I was asking the people that are on the page whether or not they had any questions about Japanese wrestling and whether or not they wanted to talk about something and maybe ask us for answers to questions that they have about Japanese wrestling today and Japanese wrestling history. So since Eric here is a Mr. Japanese history in some regards, I'm going to throw a couple questions out at him. Barry, feel free to chime in if you have an opinion on these, because some Absolutely. Of them are historical, some of them are current. So the first question that I'm going to throw at you, Eric, this comes from Stephen Knuth on the Facebook group. He wants to know what your thoughts are on the upcoming Kenny Omega Chris Jericho match at the Wrestling Kingdom show in January.
Okay, so when I first heard it, I mean, I can't lie, I just groaned. I was like, oh no, you know, for purely selfish reasons, because I'm going to this show. You know, the original rumor was Omega and Kota Ibushi, which, you know, it's going to be tremendous. You know, those two would just have a show-stealing match. And,
sure.
Chris Jericho, you know, I'm not the biggest WWE fan. I don't have anything against the people that work in that company, but I just can't watch a TV show that's filmed the way that they film. I just can't do it. Life's too short, you know, with the 722 camera switches in a 5-second period where you can't see anything. So I can't be bothered with it. And you know, Jericho's largely known as this WWE guy. And so, to me, like on a selfish level, it's like I felt like I lost Omega and Kota Ibushi. And instead I got Omega and Jericho, which, you know, it's going to be good and will probably be great because, you know, Jericho usually is great. And it's Ibushi and Cody Rhodes now. Cody doesn't do a thing for me. So, it wasn't a great trade-off losing that match to get those two. But in New Japan, you know, it really looks like they're trying to go for it in America. You know, they're running those shows out in California. They're always sending their guys over. They're at the ACW arena all the time, these New Japan guys. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jericho is a great opponent for Kenny Omega. Omega never has a bad match, it seems. And it's a good matchup to try to get, you know, the Western fans into it. They all know Jericho. It's the semi-main event, so they're going to try to steal the show. Omega's, you know, he always tries to do that. So I, you know, now after my initial groaning and pissing and moaning for no reason other than being selfish, I think that match is going to be great. I just really think it's really going to be great. It's probably the best match that they could put on, you know, to try to get westernized, you know, on this product or Americanized on this product. Cause there's not a lot of, you know, guys that you can throw in there to do that. You know, everybody's tied up in contracts now. You know, it's not like the old days where you know, guys would go to Japan and you'd have those weird matches like Bob Backlund versus Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah.
Like, what is this going? What's this doing here? You know,
Barry, let me ask you, what do you think about this upcoming match?
Yeah, so yeah, it's and it's something I'll be watching as well. It's I guess I like it. I read there was some sort of controversy where Naito didn't want to be considered, I guess, a double main event. Did you hear about that, Eric?
I haven't heard it. You know, he's a heel, so you know, I take everything that I read with him just as a heel, you know. So I don't take a lot of it serious, but they had that deal a few years ago where they had, you know, they had the match, they asked the fans to vote what the main event was, and you know, they didn't pick the one match. So, you know, maybe he's going in that direction where he doesn't want to be sharing the spotlight. He doesn't want that rehashed over again.
Yeah, so, it's definitely possible, too. But I am looking forward to this matchup. I am a big Chris Jericho fan. It's obviously, I think it's a different style. You know, Omega's been working at a different level than Jericho has for years now. But at the same time, there's something about Jericho as he approaches his 50th birthday. And I want to say he's in his late 40s. And he's a guy that has been really successful in reinventing himself. You know, he's gone through so many different changes, but he keeps himself relevant. So I'm actually looking forward to it.
Well, I got to tell you, I think, first of all, the way they promoted the match before it was announced on social media, they had the little Twitter war going on. And then with the video where Jericho was challenging Omega, I thought that was absolutely brilliant the way they did that. And it got such a huge pop when it first happened. What's going to be interesting is Omega, probably arguably one of the three or four best wrestlers in the world right now. And we're really going to see just how great he is, because Jericho, as Barry said, approaching that 50th birthday, is not the wrestler that he was 10 or 15 years ago. But that doesn't mean that this can't still be a great match, because Omega will offer the greatness as far as the ability. But you have to know that Jericho definitely is going to have the psychology down, and he's going to do everything he can from his side. What he can't do on a physical side, he's going to offer from the psychological point of view, and turning this into a battle that's going to be epic. And you're absolutely right. You know that he and Omega are going to go out there and try to steal the show.
Yeah. And I keep reading, you know, people, like, they always mention Jericho's age, which is, I don't know. It's a little odd to me, considering, you know, there's quite a few guys in New Japan who are up there.
Suzuki's
like
in
49.
His
49. Yeah. It's like he's an old man too. You know, it's Tanahashi's up there. Togi Makabe's up there. You know, a lot of those guys aren't exactly in their 20s like Okada is. So, yeah. You know, it's, I found that to be one of the weirder aspects. People just constantly bringing up Jericho's old. I'm like, yeah, they have a lot of guys that are old that they're trotting out there.
Well, I think
I think it's different too, though. I mean, I think if you're looking at guys that have been working a Japanese style that are conditioned that way, Jericho is a part-time wrestler. I mean, he literally, between, he's 50% Fozzy and 50% wrestling, hasn't had a match now in months that I'm aware of. So the fact that he's taking such a high-profile match against one of the greatest wrestlers currently wrestling, you know, on one of the biggest stages, is kind of unique.
Yeah,
it is. It is. One thing I will say, I don't watch much WWE, but when I do see it, Jericho's always really good. You know, the last thing he was doing, you know, he had that thing with the list. He was like, "You're on the list, the bad guy list," or whatever he was doing. You know, he's always very, very creative at what he does. And you know, I'm expecting a really, really great match here at the Dome. And he's a guy that we see all the time, but they don't. So the atmosphere in that building, I think, is going to be great for it, because they were really excited when he was on the screen, when they realized that he was the opponent, you know. And I think that's another thing that people look out on. That, you know, you always think it's just us Americans here. You know, they don't see Jericho. They haven't seen him in years, you know, live.
Yeah. But of course he does have the history in New Japan, you know, Chris Jericho. And so it was a name from the past that's coming back. So let me take the next question. The next question comes from Brian Huff, and also James Knight, both asked the question, was Hulk Hogan as over in Japan as he was in the States? What do you think about that?
I mean, I was younger, you know. It, from watching on TV, it looks like it. I mean, he really looks over on those matches. Hogan, he's another one of those guys. You know, in America, he's like, he's, you know, he gets beat on for 5 minutes, and then he hulks up and he hits a lame looking clothesline and he drops that leg and the match is over, and it's like, eh, you know, whatever. But over there, he's like a totally different guy. It's like he's, you know, he's doing all kind of stuff over there. And it's like, well, you know, why wouldn't he do this here? But I guess, you know, over here, he didn't have to. But, you know, he always appears super over. He's in those great old angles with, you know, knocking Inoki senseless and, you know, winning that title. You know, he's got that kind of stuff there. They always appear to be surrounding him. Remember those old clips where the guys are trying to get to the ring and it looks like, you know, they're getting, you know, aggravated, assaulted on the way to the ring. And those ring boys are just slinging people out of the way. I mean, that's what it looks like, Hogan going to the ring on those old clips. So, sure. I would say he is over. I will say that as a teenager going to the Philadelphia Spectrum in, say, 84, 85, I've never heard noise like a crowd when Hogan came out. Now, he's got to be one of the most over guys of all time, at least from what I remember. I remember a December 1984 match at the Spectrum, Hogan and the Iron Sheik, and that place, it was like that weird feeling where like your feet are vibrating on the floor because the building's so loud when that Eye of the Tiger would hit. So he was super over, and he looks super over when I watch these old tapes of him in Japan. I mean, I would say, yeah.
Okay, Barry, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I know some of his stuff from Japan. There's a Hogan versus Dusty Rhodes match that I've seen, and then I've seen that famous Inoki thing. I will echo what Eric just said, too. So I was lucky enough to see Hogan in 1984, so I guess it was kind of the year that he debuted up in the Northeast. And I was at the Garden, and I saw him at least twice. And while I'm not a fan, per se, I got to say he may be the most over wrestler I ever saw live, because, as you mentioned, the floor is vibrating. The seats were actually moving. I mean, everybody was just, you know, there was like this pandemonium once his music hit, and people were just going absolutely insane.
Yeah. So I will say I've been pretty well documented as not being a huge Hulk Hogan fan, not just the Hulk Hogan character, but Terry Bollea himself. But I will say you're absolutely right. There's no question. He was so incredibly over and drew so much money for the WWE and for the AWA before that. Now, Eric sort of alluded to it. I will say that there is a definite notice of a change of style when he's in Japan. He works much harder when he's in Japan, and there's much more of a give and take. The leg drop is not his finisher in Japan. He uses the clothesline that he calls the axe bomber. He has, if you see a match of him wrestling, I know there was a match in 1990, I want to say, with Stan Hansen. There was matches with Inoki. If you want to really see Hulk Hogan putting on his working shoes, those are the matches from, I want to say, up to about 82, 83, when he wrestles Inoki and some of the guys in Japan. He wrestles much harder and definitely is showing much more athleticism than he ever showed when he was in the WWE. So that being said, now what we're going to do is we are going to change midstream here. And one of the things on my Facebook page, facebook.com/breakingkayfabe that I mentioned earlier, that I'd ask people to suggest topics for the show. And, you know, because I work at the courthouse for some 32 years, people said, oh, you need to tell us some courthouse stories. And Eric here works at the courthouse. Barry's been to the courthouse. I think it was a criminal complaint, as I recall, Barry. You know, but
just a rumor.
That was a not guilty, so we can't talk about it. But so Eric and I are going to throw out a couple, you know, maybe one or two stories from the courthouse days. So, Eric, why don't you tell us a good courthouse story?
So I just had the trial that we were supposed to have this week was a gun charge, illegal firearm. Guy allegedly shot at people in a crowd. And so we're sitting there and the government's witness is running late, their star witness. And, you know, there's people sitting in the crowd and the guy's at the table and he's there with his defense attorney. And finally, we had the jury in the back. Thankfully, we didn't have the jury out. And the lady comes rushing in, you know, sorry, I'm late. You know, so the district attorney says, oh, you know, I'll talk to you outside. You know, to go over what I'm going to ask you up here. And she stops and she looks at the table and she says, who's that? And he says, it's the guy that shot in the crowd. And she went, no, it's not. So it's like, oh, geez. You know, and everybody was like, what? And the guy was like, I told you it wasn't me. You know, he's hollering. And
puts a real damper on the state's case, huh?
Yeah, and it's, you know, then it was, you know, null pros, people that don't know that government had to say, oh, you know, we're just going to let this guy go. She's saying it's not him, you know. It's like, what are you going to do? So it was like, oh, Jesus.
So,
you know,
this week we're in court and a guy is getting ready to take a change of plea. And he stands up there and his mom and dad, I want to say early 20s, mom and dad are in the courtroom. So the judge says, mom and dad, why don't you come up and, you know, we'll tell you what's going on here. So the guy is getting ready to take a plea to I believe the charge was criminal mischief. And as the judge is explaining what's going to happen to him, you know, dad, what do you do? Oh, I work in the mental health field. I'm a counselor for addiction and that kind of stuff. And so so then she gets to the part where she's getting ready to take the plea from the guy. And so she's saying, you're going to plead no contest. This is what it means. And as we're watching the guy, all of a sudden we look, his eyes start rolling back in his head. And he does, as I told Barry the story, he does the Ric Flair face plant. Boom, right down there on the floor. Okay. So mom immediately starts wailing. Oh my God, he's having one of those seizures again. Oh my God, what are we going to do? The father stands there, doesn't move a muscle, and looks at him and says, is he breathing? Like, not running to the guy and saying, oh my God, my son, is he breathing? He stood there as if nothing, is he breathing? So then they call the EMS, they call the court deputies, they all come up and they're trying to assist the guy. So the EMS guys look to mom and they go, mom, has he got any sort of medical histories, any sort of medication that he's taking? Oh yeah, he's on a medication for blood thinners because he gets blood clots. Oh, okay, that's good to know. Anything else? Oh yeah, by the way, he's schizophrenic. So at this point, the judge rolls the chair over to me and goes, did she just say schizophrenic? This guy could have taken out the entire courtroom if he wanted to. That falls under the you need to know kind of stuff. So yeah, that was pretty interesting. So Eric, you got anything else there?
So Jeff, in your courtroom, do you pick juries? Is it like a jury courtroom?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
So it's so annoying, you know, when you work there, you know, the people that are actively trying to get out of jury duty, you know, it's so irritating. You know, what we do here in Philadelphia, I assume you guys do the same, is the judge will talk to them all as a group and then he questions them individually. And some of the stuff that these people try to come up with to get out of it is, it's just amazing.
We get the no speak of the English.
You always get, you get that, you know, the English stuff. But we had a guy who said that he raised his hand for a hardship because when Sunday was the season premiere of Game of Thrones, and he was behind and he was trying to catch up watching Game of Thrones so that he could watch it on Sunday live, because he said, Your Honor, in this day and age with this internet stuff, people ruin it. So I can't watch it Monday. You know, I have to watch it Sunday. And if I do this jury duty, I'm not going to get caught up. You know, that's my whole.
So he was offering the Game of Thrones defense.
Yeah, he was using the Game of Thrones defense. And, you know, we also have a pissy judge in Philadelphia. He's a great room to work in because he doesn't take any nonsense from people. And you always get those people, you know, why can't you do it? Oh, well, my job. You know, everybody has the most important job in the world with no backup. You know what I mean? It's like the craziest thing, you know, and they always say, well, what's your job doing while you're here today? You know, it's like they seem to be surviving just fine.
Exactly.
So the guy was pulling that, you know, I'm the only one at my job that does this, you know. So the judge says, and I don't even know if the judge is allowed to do this. He just sort of puts the fear into people. So he looks at me and he says, Eric, get me the phone number. Or he said to the guy, you know, so how long have you worked there? And the guy said, 8 years I've been there. So the judge said, Eric, I need you to get me the human resources phone number for this company. And he said, sir, I'm going to call your human resource department, and you better have 8 years of perfect attendance while you've worked there. Because what you're telling me is that you can't be out for 3 or 4 days. So there better be no vacations or no sick time or any of that. Because what you're telling me is this company will crumble without you. And if there are days that you're out, contempt of court is 5 months and 29 days. And then they all immediately go, oh, well, I guess I could take 3 or 4 days off. Yeah, you know, like all of a sudden, they go, you know. So
funny how that works, huh?
But I don't have a lot of funny stories, unfortunately, because I spent a year working in the sexual assault courtroom. And, you know, that's a rough courtroom to work
in. Yeah, it's not big humor.
There's no humor whatsoever. Yeah, there's no humor at all there. It's very, very sad listening to a lot of these stories. So,
yeah. So I got
usually when you get the other rooms, like the DUI rooms.
Exactly. And that's what I primarily work with. I work with
DUI. All kind of comedy in there.
So I have a guy a couple of years ago that was in court. He was pleading out a charge of reckless driving. So he's got his girlfriend and a baby with her. And so the judge is sentencing him. And so she's telling the guy, okay, you need to, you know, be careful. You got your girlfriend and the baby here. You don't want anything to happen to them. And the judge, you know, asks, how old is the baby? And then the guy looks at her and says, oh, that's not my baby. It was supposed to be my baby, but that's not my baby. So, you know, I always say the best part of my job is just when you think you've seen everything. Yeah, you haven't seen anything, because it's
One of the things that I don't say anymore is a phrase that people use is, now I've seen it all.
Yeah.
And when you work in criminal court, you've never seen it all.
Yeah. So, okay, now that we've fed a few courthouse stories, just whetted the appetite of the listener, as it were, more to come, perhaps. Let's go back.
Those.
Yeah. We're going to go and talk a little Tom Petty. So, as you know, October 2nd of this year, we lost Tom Petty. And boy, I don't know about you guys, but the last couple of years, if you're a fan of music, has just been brutal. I mean, right off the top of my head, I'm thinking Glenn Frey, Prince, David Bowie, guys, anybody else? I'm right off the top of my head.
Joe Cocker.
Prince. So many singers that we've lost. So I reached out to Eric and to Barry, and what we talked about doing was we are going to come up with our own top five Tom Petty songs. And let me tell you something. You know, we talked about Seinfeld last week being a difficult assignment. Coming up with only five Tom Petty songs is going to be tough. So, Barry, why don't you start off and tell us what your number five, and we'll see how much lapping over we have on each other's list. And I don't think there are going to be many on mine, because I really only have one Tom Petty song that was anything close to being a top 40 song. So tell me what your number five is.
Yeah, and before I do, too, let me say, so when David Bowie and Prince died, Eric actually texted me, and I remember the one day, and I don't know if it was Bowie or Prince, but Eric texted me, and it just said, it said, fuck. And I apologize for, right, but it said, fuck, and then it goes, Prince just died. Do you remember that, Eric?
Yes.
Yeah, and the truth is, losing Bowie, in my opinion, losing Bowie, Prince, and Tom Petty within a year and a half of each other and so close to each other, it's devastating, but this list was really, really hard, and you're right, that Seinfeld list, and we've obviously done a bunch of other things that have been difficult. So my number five song it's an audible, Jeff. I'm stealing a line from you. I'm basically calling an audible, because it came down to two songs and I had to choose. And I had two songs. It was either Free Fallin' or Learning to Fly, and I went with Learning to Fly.
Great song.
Yeah, you know, look, whatever we say, we're not going to be, there's no wrong answer with this, obviously, but I love both of those songs, and, you know, Petty was a generation for us. You know, it was something in high school. He was absolutely, Petty and the original Van Halen were really the two rock acts that my high school was built around, and I had so many friends that went up to Gainesville to go to school, and apparently, I remember hearing this story, but they would go up, and his dad's name was Earl Petty, and he was still listed in the phone book, and kids that were going up there would actually call his dad just to discuss Tom Petty with him, which I always felt was cool. But Learning to Fly, I just think, is such a great song. It's one of those songs that comes on, I hear it, and I automatically get a smile on my face.
Absolutely. Okay, so, Eric, what's your number five?
My number five is not a hit. Song called King's Highway from Into the Great Wide Open. It's such a great song. I love the catchy chorus. I love those. One of the things that I like about Tom Petty is I like those jangly guitars. Like I always like the Birds.
Sure.
And early REM, Murmur, and you know that kind of stuff. Those jangly guitars. I love that sound. Petty has a lot of it. So my number five was King's Highway. It's an album track. If you don't know, you should seek it out. It's a great song. And I probably sent Barry one of those fuck texts for Tom Petty, too, since that sort of came out of nowhere. He was just at the Wells Fargo Center on July 29th. I worked at the concert. And when I saw the news, when people were sending me the text, you always get that reaction like, are these people messing around with me? You know what I mean? It's like, I was like, he didn't seem to be sick. You know, he was just here. I was like, what do you mean he died? He was just here 2 months ago. You know, he looked fine. You know, like, well, what are you talking about?
So,
you're right. Not a great couple years.
I'll tell you, like, Tom Petty, if you lived in Florida, I've said this before, you know, people that grew up in the Northeast, so much of people that are in our general age group, you know, Springsteen was the guy. And I know for people that lived in the, you know, the Midwest, you had, you know, John Cougar Mellencamp was the guy that spoke to people of that area. But in Florida, it was, you know, you're talking Skinner, you're talking Tom Petty. And Tom Petty was the guy that spoke to my generation, I really felt like. And my number five song, the first time I heard it was a live version. And Tom Petty starts off the song Breakdown. I heard a live version was a real slow drum beat. And he eventually picks it up. And the crowd begins singing the chorus. And they sing the entire first chorus, and Tom Petty leans into the microphone and he says, y'all going to put me out of a job, man. And I was so hooked on that song. And, it, you know, it's just such a great song about a guy that's being led to a breakdown by a girl. And a lot of the songs that I like from Petty are songs that deal with a guy that's been screwed over by a girl. And you know, it's just the way, you know. And I've always found that my two favorite Petty albums were the first album that I really discovered Tom Petty. I was a guy that when I was growing up in high school, I was really into top 40 music, and I didn't do I wasn't into really classic rock while it was going on. Don't ask me why. But the first Petty album I really got into was Damn the Torpedoes when I was in college. And I can easily say that was one of the first albums that I really listened the entire thing. I listened to the deep cuts. You know, I listened to songs like Louisiana Rain and Century City, not just, you know, Don't Do Me Like That or Refugee. I mean, I listened to the entire album, and it's a great album. And then I listened to Wait Until Dark, which was much like that. It was a very dark album. And he was going through some marital trouble at the time. And a lot of what the songs are about is people struggling to get through these emotional crises. And, but those were always my two favorite Petty albums. So number four, Barry, give us your number four pick.
Yeah. Number four is a more upbeat. It's Jammin' Me, from the 1987 album, Let Me Up. I've Had Enough. And I always loved Jammin' Me. It was a, that's another song. It comes on and I try to make it as loud as I possibly can. So yeah, love it, man.
Okay, Eric, give us your number four.
My number four, Jeff, I do want to say I hate you for making me do this.
That's what I'm here for. You know,
it's like, you know, I have a top five list, and there's no free fall, and there's no I won't back down. There's no, you know, that's, these are great songs, and I'm chopping them off. It's a terrible thing to do to somebody to choose between great things like that.
Well, that's why when we have three guys, your top five list ends up being 15 songs. So I figure we're, you know. Okay.
But, well, we got to repeat here because my number four is Learning to Fly. I love Learning to Fly. It's got those jangly guitars that I like. I think that's on, I think it's on In the Great Wide Open. That's such a great record. I love it. Handle with Care is not on my list either. I guess you could technically say that's Petty too. God, Jeff, go away.
Okay, so my number four, I'll tell you a little historical background on me. I've told people before, I don't know if everyone knows this, I'm on my third marriage. And I know, it's not, you know, I like to tell people I've talked three women into marrying me. You know, you guys that have only been married to one woman, you're just rookies. you know, when it comes to the love department. So on one of Petty's live albums, he has a song called I'm in Love. And it's just basically where he shouts out to the crowd and he says, hey, y'all know what? And he kind of doesn't get the response he wants. And he goes, y'all know what? And the crowd goes, what? And he just says, I'm in love. And he goes and starts. And it's a cover song. But I was sitting at work one day on a break, and I'm just out there, and I'm just, you know, I like to tell people that when I put my headphones on with my iPod and I'm listening to music, that's, for me, is going to church, because that's where I basically unwind from the stress of work. And as I listened to that song one day, and my wife and I have been together for 19 years now, and I sat there and just realized that this song was about my wife. And I realized, you know, after two marriages that ended in divorce, and I'm in my third marriage, and we've been together, and I used to tell people, you know, my parents have been married 66 years, and here I'm on my third marriage, and I used to think, this is not going to happen. I don't know why. Some sort of a gene splice or something that just doesn't mean for me to be married long to somebody. And Lord knows my wife has put up with me for a long time. And when I hear a song like that, it just reminds me why, you know, we're still together.
Well, great. So, glad to hear this third one seems to be working out.
Yeah,
19 years. You finally seem to figure it out.
Jeff's wife is fantastic as well. She gives me a hard time all the time, but it took you three times to get it right, Jeff, you know, definitely.
Absolutely. So what's your number three, Barry?
So my number three is A Face in the Crowd from Full Moon Fever, 1989. And one of the things that I truly like about Tom Petty, it's whether he's doing something slower, a little more melodic, or he's full out, you know, jamming me, he's able to connect. And it's really the sign of a true musician. And so I love the song. It's A Face in the Crowd. It's a little, maybe it's a little melancholy. I listen to it. I think it's beautiful. And at the same time, you know, maybe it makes me just a tiny bit sad, but again, I think it's true art is going to move you. And I feel that this song is true art.
Absolutely. Okay. Eric, what's your next one?
I guess it's little known. My third is, it's called The Wild One Forever. Such a great, great song. I love it. I love that guitar in the beginning. It's a quick song. I don't even think it's 3 minutes long. I love the melody to this song. I love the lyrics to this song. Something I Saw in Your Eyes told me right away that you were going to have to be mine. It's such a great visual image that he puts in that song. It's a very early Tom Petty song. If you don't know it, you should definitely check that out. It's a great song.
It is a great song. It's perhaps one that I'll be bringing up, Mr. Spoiler alert. So my number three is a song called Straight Into Darkness. It's also on the Wait Until Dark album. And as I said, this was a song that Petty was writing at a very dark period in his life where he was going through some marital troubles with his first wife. But what's great about this song is it ends on a hopeful note. And I believe he's quoted as saying, you know, I don't believe the thrill is gone. You know, real love is a man's salvation. The weak ones fall and the strong carry on. And that's something that I really believe in, you know, that true love can really be a man's salvation. Lord knows it was with mine that my wife still puts up with me. So, Barry, what's your number two?
Number two is Don't Come Around Here No More, Southern Accents, 1985. So this one is a song. I was very fortunate in 1985 to be able to make several cross-country trips between Miami and Los Angeles. I was living out in L.A., but my dad was sick, and I was going back and forth. And being it was 1985, I either had a cassette or I was listening to the radio. And this song was so huge in 85 that I literally, you know, it was just playing almost nonstop in my car. It's also, I think, one of the best videos. It's that whole Alice in Wonderland, and at the end they're eating Alice. She's a cake. So a lot of it goes with the video as well. But I just love the song. I love the video. And it's unique. It's definitely different than a lot of his other work. And there's a sitar in there, which is Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics. And also he makes it in the video. But just a fantastic song.
Love it. Love it. Okay. That was one I chopped off, and I hated Jeff for it.
There you go.
There's a lot of hate going on here.
We're gonna, Jeff, if I was next to you, I'd be throwing some of those Takata kicks at the back of your leg.
But the Yamazaki kicks would be quicker. That's all I'm going to say. My number two
There's no quick about me, Jeff. None.
My number two song is the aforementioned The Wild One Forever.
Very good.
Let me tell you why. The Wild One Forever, I believe, is on the very first Tom Petty album. The Wild One Forever really came back to me recently. You know, when my second marriage ended, I got into a relationship for a short period of time with someone that was completely wrong. And wrong for me. It was someone I shouldn't have been involved with. Lots of regret. And not only regret, there was a lot of bitterness that I kept inside that I felt towards this person. And it had to do with the fact that she was basically given a choice and she decided to choose someone else over me. Go figure. I mean, you know, who would not choose me? What? I have so much to offer. So I was very bitter about this, sort of kept it to myself. And then one day I was listening to this song. And as I listened to the song and it deals with a guy that's been involved in a relationship with somebody who's the complete wrong person for him. And he realizes it. But what happens is he realizes that although this person was wrong, he's not going to ever regret it. And it was something that happened and that he's finally come to grips with it and that he's finally been able to forgive her. And after, good Lord, 20 years, I finally realized that I need to let this go and that this is past. She did what she did, and I've let it go and forgiven her for this decision she decided to make. Because also, I sit there and think, if she had chosen me, my life would have been a lot different. Not necessarily for the better, may I say. There's a reason I call her the spawn of hell. But anyway, that's another story for another time. That's, trust me, an entire podcast I could do about that situation. So,
coming up on a very special Breaking Kayfabe. Yeah. We already have our topic for next week. Great.
Jeff discusses the disillusion of his second marriage. Yeah, that, trust me. Our producer will be like, what do you mean 3 hours? Okay, Barry, give me your number one.
3 hours on the first date.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so my number one is so much
you're
like
number two,
you with
two,
your number
Barry, two.
No, I'm number one.
Oh, it's number one time.
I'm there.
No, I'm there. Two.
Try to keep
number
up.
We're two, gang.
No.
No, sir.
Yes.
Wild One Forever was my number two. My number three was Straight Into Darkness.
Oh, right. Yes, but Barry hasn't given his number two.
I did. It was Don't Come Around Here No More.
Try to keep up, Eric. Come on.
Eric, wait, this is a highbrow podcast,
that's
Eric.
That's right.
Listen,
we have been told we're highbrow. You are not acting highbrow.
I had Five Kings Highway, four Learning to Fly, three Wild One Forever. I never did the two.
How do we skip over Eric?
I jumped in because I felt like I'm the host and I need to tell everyone.
That explains it. Eric,
go ahead and give us
Eric, you're number two. We apologize.
We're never having you on this show again, Eric.
So number two, I had a hard time choosing between my number one and number two, but number two, I'm going to go with The Waiting. It's got those jangly guitars that I like. It's one of his bigger hits, and it's used to perfection in an episode of The Simpsons, if you guys have not seen this. So there's an episode where Homer Simpson is trying to buy a gun because he wants to go to the shooting range, you know. But he's waiting for the license to come in, so he can't shoot the gun. So he's sitting on the sidewalk, like melancholy, in a beach chair with the gun in his hand. As all these people that he hates, like Flanders, that Marge's two sisters, keep walking past him back and forth, you know, and they're playing The Waiting, you know, because he's waiting for it's for him to be able to shoot the gun. He can't fire the gun yet because he's waiting for the license. So all these people that he hates, all targets are going past him. It's just really a funny scene, but that's such a great song. It's one of his better songs. And, you know, one of my biggest regrets is he just died. And on that July 29th show at the Wells Fargo Center, he inexplicably did not perform it. So it was kind of a bummer.
You keep rubbing it in too, and I was so tempted to go to that show, and I couldn't get a ticket, and then I was going to do StubHub, and it was going to cost me an arm and a leg. Of course, now I want to run out in the middle of traffic, the fact that I didn't go to that show. Yeah, exactly. But so you bring up a good point. The Waiting is a fantastic song. So every time somebody says to me, like my wife will say, I've been waiting for you, I look at her and say, that's the hardest part.
Me too. And
much like Seinfeld, the Seinfeld episode we did last week, whenever somebody says my friend, I always respond with, the sea was angry that day, my friend. And, yes. Exactly. So when you say The Waiting, to me, it's always been the hardest part. Moops!
So, okay. Eric, number one.
All right. So my number one is... I picked Even the Losers. It's such a great song. Oh. It's very relatable. Listen, we all have there's that 1% of this population where everything goes right for them, and you know they're billionaires. But look, most of us are Charlie Brown, right? You know what I mean? We go through life being Charlie Brown, and every once in a while something works out for us, you know? Jeff finally meets the girl, you know, after two fiascos and a dating fiasco, and he finally meets the right girl. You know, even Jeff found it. You know what I mean? It's like
The song was not Even Jeff Bowdrin. The song was Even the Losers. Thank you, Mr. Not Gonna Be on the Show Again.
But you know, we all have that Charlie Brown in us. You know, it's like you'll get the front row for the concert once in a while. You know, you might catch the foul ball once in your life. You know, you might get the pretty girl on the bar actually says hello to you and not the other guy. You know what I mean? It's like, so it's such a great relatable song, and I love everything about it. It's a great topic for a song. Yeah, that's my number one. I had a tough time picking number one, but I'm going to go with that one.
Okay, before I give you my
excellent choice.
Before I give you my number one, because I'm the host.
Well, Jeff, I never went.
I thought you did your number one. What kind of show is this?
Next week, I'm going to get an abacus for everybody, so we can sit here and we can just chart them and go. I mean, it's only 5-1, too. It's not like we're starting in, like, you know, 2 billion. It's 5-1.
This is a professional
podcast. How is it, you know, what kind of show is this?
Well, it's one that's not advertising the Dollar Shave Club, so that'll tell you something right there.
There you go. Not yet. So, being said, we're going to take a dramatic turn right now. So this song is deeply personal to me, much like your number two was deeply personal to you, Jeff. This was a song that, and this is where, you can do the violins right now. This a song that I happened to hear twice on the radio the same day that my dad died. And I was extremely close with my dad, as close as, you know, I guess a father and a son could be, and it's Runaway Trains. And I was driving to the funeral home, and you know, obviously I'm very distressed, and the song comes on, and if I can just, you know, I'm not going to sing this to save everybody a lot of grief, but you know, some of the lyrics, it's just one of those things you can never explain, like when an angel cries, like runaway trains, like one of those times that's never the same, like when something dies, like runaway trains. So I heard that twice the day that my dad died, and it had a massive impact on me. And I wound up playing that song on a daily basis for probably 3 months after, just because it, you know, was kind of part of the healing process for me. So deeply personal. I love the song. I hear it, and you know, immediately I'll think of my dad.
Okay, so Eric, have we gotten all five of yours?
You have.
Barry, have we gotten all five of yours?
Yes, sir.
Okay, because I certainly wouldn't want to leave anybody out. Now, because I'm the host of this show, I'm going to just trump you guys and real quickly tell you what the rest of my top 10 list is before I get to number one, because I can do that. My number 10, don't do me like that. Number 9, Here Comes My Girl. Number 8, Stories We Could Tell. Number 7, You Got Lucky. Number 5, or number 6, the aforementioned The Waiting. So now we've gotten to my number one song. My number one song, much like Barry, is a very personal song to me. and it's a song that's on the album of the same name. It's called Southern Accents.
Yep.
My mother is from South Carolina, and every summer we would visit my mother's parents in South Carolina when I was growing up as a kid. And so all my relatives from that side of the family spoke with a Southern accent. And so when I first heard this song, and the lyrics go, there's a Southern accent where I come from. The youngins call it country. The Yankees call it dumb. I got my own way of talking, but everything gets done with a Southern accent where I come from. And boy, when I first heard that, and it, there's other great songs on that album, but wow, it just cut me right to the bone. And it really made me think of my mom. It made me think of my grandparents. Every time I hear it, it still cuts deep and reminds me of all those summers as a kid going up to Buford, South Carolina, on the coast in the low country of South Carolina. And it made me think of her. And so, yeah, had a lot of emotional meaning to me, had a big impact with me. And that being said, about time to wrap it up. Boys, any last words? Eric, before we go, I do want to mention you're going to Japan soon, aren't you? You said?
Yes, I leave on the 29th.
And you're going to be there for how long?
I'll be there until whatever the Monday is, the 8th or the 9th. I don't know the date offhand.
I don't know about Barry, but I'll be placing my orders for merchandise for you to buy.
Oh, here we go.
Here we go, Eric.
Totokan know me well.
So, and you're looking, are you going to see anything besides the Tokyo Dome show?
Oh, yeah. We got a pretty packed schedule. 01 promotion runs on New Year's Day, which is always a pretty fun show. It's a fan appreciation show where all the tickets are only 2,000 yen. So that's a nice little show. All Japan runs the 2nd and the 3rd. Tokyo Dome's the 4th. The 5th is the New Year's Dash New Japan show. That's when we're going to meet up with Minoru Suzuki to give him the money for Takayama. And then a couple days of sightseeing after that. So
very nice. So do you, would you say that one of the Omega matches with Okada? Wow, I drew a complete blank there for a second. Was that your match of the year in Japan, do you think?
Yes.
Which one?
Yes. I'm going to go with the Tokyo Dome match just because I was there.
Yeah.
And it was incredibly dramatic in that building. A lot of times you watch these Tokyo Dome shows and you think the crowd's not into it because the building's so big and it doesn't project well on TV. But that crowd's really into it live at that show. And the last 10 minutes of that match, that was the one, they did the 60-minute draw later, but we were thinking at that show, they might go 60 because you hear that guy at ringside 35 minutes in, 40 minutes in. It's like, man, they're really getting up there, and I think it went like 44 minutes or something like that before Okada hit the spinning pile driver into the Rainmaker.
Yeah.
Pin. But that it's a tough choice. Okada is literally in the greatest run of all time, I think, for a champion. I mean,
yeah, he's truly amazing. Yeah. So, Barry, do you get to see any of the current stuff?
I do. I watched a little bit last night on Access TV. So I do. I just, between watching Twilight Zones and Seinfeld, my time is limited.
I got to tell you, I watched a little bit of that Access show. The tag title change with, is it Show and Go? Is that their name, Eric?
Show and Yo.
Yo.
Yeah.
Those guys were great. I really enjoyed that match.
Yeah.
That was a terrific match where they won the IWGP tag titles. So,
they're
once again,
junior
before
champs,
we,
yeah.
Yeah. Before we go, Eric, why don't you give them the Facebook page that you run? What's it called?
It's Classic Japanese Pro Wrestling. And like I said, you can't search it. You need an existing member to add you in. But it's a very serious group, like Barry's Florida group. We don't put up with, the nonsense or the posts where it looks like their IQs are in the single digits. We just get rid of those people right away. So it's a fun, smart group to be in. You learn a lot in there. I mean, I've been watching Japanese wrestling since 1984, and I learned something in there every day from those guys. Those guys are great in there.
Sure. That's great. So, okay, folks. Well, listen, you can follow me on Twitter, at Baldrin Jeff. My book, Breaking Kayfabe, is still available at crowbarpress.com with my good friend Scott Teal. The second book being worked on, I got through 3 chapters this week. I have set a deadline for myself for the end of the year for my Baldrin the Booker book that I'm coming up with. I'm still working on a title. You guys throw out some title suggestions for me there. I was thinking of I Was a Teenage Booker. But also, we want to thank Travis Heckel for the incredible artwork for the new Breaking Kayfabe, which will be called Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. Woohoo, Barry, you're part of a podcast.
So Breaking to celebrate.
Yeah, special thanks to my man Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, the mothership. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Until next week's folks, hasta la vista. We'll see you later. Thanks for listening.